Watergate burglars. They also broke into the office of Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist. We will be talking with them about that, about the presidential pardon, about why they got involved in the first place, and many other subjects. That's coming up in just a moment. With me this morning are Eugenio Martinez, who is on my far right, and Bernard Barker, two men who served jail terms for having burglarized the Democratic Party headquarters at the Watergate complex in Washington. In the October issue of Harper's Magazine, Martinez and Barker and E. Howard Hunt and Gordon Liddy and others speak out on how they now view all of what has happened. It makes interesting reading, but this morning we would like to learn a little more. Let me begin with a couple of general questions. How long have you been in prison, Mr. Barker?
Well, I was in prison 1 year, 22 days, and 2 hours.
Mr. Martinez?
I spent almost 15 months.
You both are Cubans by birth. You have been employed by the Central Intelligence Agency of the United States for a number of years in activities directed against the Castro government. Would you briefly tell us what you did during that time?
During the time of the Castro takeover in Cuba, we acted against the Castro government in their development of a communist state in Cuba, both in the interest of the Cuban people and of the American people.
Mr. Martinez?
Well, I worked a little longer. I started in the early 60s, and I believe I was fired, according to Mr. Hunt, the deputy director of the CIA at the time of the Watergate break-in. He said about 72 hours or 48 hours. I never have been notified, so...
You were never notified that your employment at the Central Intelligence Agency was terminated?
No, but I assume, because I never have been contacted at that time or received any payment.
At the time you broke into the psychiatrist's office who had treated Dr. Ellsberg, and at the time you broke into the Watergate complex at the Democratic Party headquarters, did you feel you were working for the Central Intelligence Agency?
Yes, I did.
Did you, Mr. Barker?
No, I did not.
How were you contacted? Who did you think you were working for?
And I was contacted.
What were you told?
I was contacted by E. Howard Hunt 10 years to the day of the April the 17th, which is the day that we commemorate the martyrs that died in the Cuban beaches.
Mm-hmm.
At that time when I arrived home, there was a note on my door that said, if you are the same Barker I knew 10 years ago, call me in such and such place, which I did. Then in our relationship with Mr. Hunt, who had been my immediate superior during the Bay of Pigs episode, we established a relationship that eventually became recruitment on matters involving national security, which was the original Ellsberg psychiatrist break-in.
You knew Hunt was working for the White House?
That is correct. I had met Mr. Hunt at one time at the Executive Mansion, and I was aware that he was a member of the executive staff, yes.
It seems to me also in reading your comments that you felt at the time that he was also employed by the Central Intelligence Agency.
Let's put it this way. On many occasions he said he was not. This is part of the procedure. I cannot say he was or I cannot say he wasn't.
You also leave the impression at the end of the article that anybody who has ever worked for the Central Intelligence Agency always works for them.
I think that many of the people that have worked for the agency, at least most of the ones that I have spoken to, are people that, when they start working for the agency, they believe in the principle of what the agency stands for. And after they finish, and they feel they have accomplished something worthy for the country, always have a very deep feeling of love for what our agency represents to this country.
In all the years that you worked for the CIA, Mr. Martinez, you might want to answer this question. Trying to bring about the fall of the Castro government, were you ever ordered to commit burglaries or other crimes here in the United States?
No, I never was asked to do such a thing.
The only affairs that you were involved in were the Ellsberg case and the Watergate case.
And they did not represent it, as you just asked me the question.
And I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
I said that they never represented to me that I was going to commit a burglary or any legal
entities. Illegal.
So they represented to me that it was a legal action which was to preserve national security.
Breaking into an office of a doctor and breaking into the office of one of the major political parties in the United States, you felt was legal?
It was not my fault because I do not have too much chance to discuss my orders. But I thought that people who were in so high a position, and you have to understand that we were receiving calls directly from the White House to our office. And by my experiences, my 11 years working with individuals in higher level of the government, I never thought that those people could lead me into anything that could be illegal at any minute.
It didn't occur to you that breaking in would be illegal?
No, because I was aware that those things have taken place. And I believe it's known that the FBI and other agencies do it sometime in order to preserve national security.
What national security were we protecting by breaking into Watergate?
Well, at that time, it was represented to us that a traitor to this country has delivered to the Soviet embassy very important documents.
Well, that's the Ellsberg case.
The Ellsberg case, which was prior to the Watergate.
Yes.
About 9 months before the Watergate.
What were you told to get inside the doctor's office?
It was about 5 minutes before we went into the psychiatrist's office, we were told what the objective of our work was going to be.
What was the objective?
I believe that Barker can answer you better that question because
Barker,
he was told what to do.
What was the objective?
The objective was to obtain documentation regarding Daniel Ellsberg.
What sort of documentation?
The type of documentation that exists in a psychiatrist's office.
What would that
be? I may add to what the question that you asked Mr. Martinez involving the Watergate, that our mission in the Watergate was not one of burglarizing. It was a surreptitious entry destined to obtain documentary information as to contributions to the Democratic Party by Castro government through different organizations. And I believe that a written statement was published in the press emanating from Mr. Dean's office to the effect that this information was there and that they had information which we can only believe came from the FBI or the CIA.
In other words, you thought that you would find evidence in the Watergate burglary that would link contributions from the Castro government to the Democratic Party?
Those were the instructions we had from the superior, from our superiors. Our superiors, Mr. Hunt, was my personal superior in the Bay of Pigs invasion. I worked directly for him. It is a matter of record now, as he has stated in his book, I was his principal assistant. And this is the way the operation was presented to us. And we had absolute trust and confidence at that time in who they were, what they represented, and we had every reason to believe at that time that they did represent proper authority.
That the money that was used to finance you and Mr. Martinez and others came to you from Mexico, and you asked no questions about that.
The Mexican operation, I know, because I was personally involved in that, and this is a subject that came up during the trials and later on and the Watergate, Senate Watergate hearings. Our only intervention in the money that came through Mexico was to bring this into the country once it was sent from Mexico, turn it into cash, and turn it over to Mr. Liddy. This came out at all of the trials And this is the only intervention that we had in that money. It is my understanding that this was operational money for perhaps this or other projects, but I would have no reason to know the exact destiny of this type of money.
Were the two of you supported while you were in jail and during a trial by money payments?
During the first part of the trial, we received very little support. Then after that, none whatsoever. As a matter of fact, we formed committees in the Cuban colony, and in order to help our families while we were in jail. As a matter of fact, we're very grateful to an article written by Mr. Buckley in that sense, which brought us approximately $6,000 that helped in paying our attorney fees.
I wonder if you feel now, today, 1974, that you did anything wrong in either the Watergate burglary or the break-in to Dr. Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office?
This is a matter for the deepest consideration. I mean, just where does a man stop to consider what right his superiors have in ordering him to do a mission, that the type of mission that he has done before for this country? Let us put it this way. If you ask me to do work to uncover a traitor who has passed information to the Soviet embassy, and in Mr. Hunt's own words at the Ellsberg trial, who was being considered at the time as a Soviet agent, my instinct, due to my training and the background in which the Cubans have worked with the government of the United States, is to go ahead and do these things.
In other words, you'd do it again.
What I'm saying is that I'm always at the service of my country. But as it has resulted, as the evidence has come out in the Ellsberg and the Watergate case, it perhaps brings a doubt today as to the legitimacy of the orders given to us. However, I believe that there is no doubt that we had every reason to believe that the White House orders emanating from the White House were proper authority orders.
Mr. Martinez, one final question here before we have to move along. In the article, you said that you had made 350 missions inside Cuba after Castro took over for the Central Intelligence Agency, and you were involved with getting people out. That was one of your prime missions. Is that correct?
Not exactly. Our operations have a wider range.
That was
of
one of the things that you did.
No, absolutely no.
Then perhaps this is incorrect.
I mean, we took people out that were fighting in the underground.
And you said in this article that you followed orders to the extent that you did not bring out your mother and father, and that they died in Cuba.
Absolutely. I never was supported in bringing them out. And when I request permission to do so, they told me that if I will do it, it will jeopardize some other operations. So I realized that that was true. As a matter of fact, one time in a mission, I was what they call missing in action. I was left in Cuba for a period of time, and I was not even able to contact them, nor to jeopardize the people in the underground. And they promised me to bring it out through the Swiss embassy and through other channels, but they never did, and both died in Cuba.
I'm sorry, I can't. Are we out of time? Okay, we have to stop here for a commercial, but we'll be back in just a minute. Walker, I'd like to ask you your opinion on the pardon of President Nixon.
I agree that the pardon of the president was for the best interest of the country. And I'm personally glad that this has happened. I would not wish the type of suffering which I have been submitted to on any other man.
That's a prison
But I believe...
The trial and prison sentence.
That is correct. Mm-hmm. But I believe that this country has other greater problems now than the pursuing this presidential vindictiveness. I think that we should be more interested in the problems of inflation, mm-hmm. of the interrelations outside of the country, mm-hmm. of the need for mortgage money and so forth.
You
and
don't feel that
dedicate time now to this problem is not the type of thing we need in our
You
country.
Don't feel that the two of you were left out on a limb, left holding the bag, as it were, Mr. Martinez?
Well, I'm glad for Nixon as a person and for his family not to go through the same thing that we went, because mm-hmm. I believe that our prison system is real bad. I do not deserve anywhere in this country to go to jail. I mean, because it's so bad mm-hmm. that I don't believe that there is rehabilitation or anything. Pardon, consider myself as a person. I don't think that I will request it. I'm appealing. I never thought that I was doing anything wrong. I was not motivated with criminal intent to do any one of my operation. But I believe that from the White House, maybe, or from the court, it would be clear that carrying order from the higher authorities of this country, trusting the people that you have trust, that you put in election, is having our only crime. And the only thing that we have left is our names. We have no money. We have been already in jail. We were sentenced to 50 years in jail by Sirica. In the first time, I served 14, 15 months in jail. And the only thing that I want is to clear my name of no wrongdoing. So I will not ask for pardon.
Eugenio Martinez, Bernard Barker, two of the Watergate burglars. We've been discussing these issues with them, and we have now a message.
McDonald's Big Mac.
Responsibility than they did.
Yes.
Didn't anybody tell any of these guys any of that?
Well, let's
only you and me.
I think. I want to say something that. I want to say one thing. First of all, I don't know. I don't know where you read anything mentioning the name Eagle Krogh in this context. But
because that was one of the arguments.
What David is saying, and what's wrong with what he's saying, I don't think really is the point that you're raising. What's wrong with what he's saying is that he's talking about sentencing. And that doesn't even get a chance.
But your sentencing report about Eagle Krogh, you said hasn't he suffered enough.
But sentencing... Yeah. No, I didn't say that at all, in the sentencing report. But let's pass that a minute. You can't get to the issue of how people ought to be sentenced in blue-collar crimes or white-collar crimes or street crimes until they've been convicted. So that the whole argument that he's making can only arise after President Nixon had been indicted and convicted. That's what's wrong with that argument. But what I really was saying, David, and you obviously will have a compelling demonstration of why what I just said is not so, but what I was thinking of in street crime, or when I use the word ghetto residents, was not so much the question of crimes that require the removal of people from society. I have a distinct recollection once when I was an assistant United States attorney of a prosecution of a woman for stealing lamb chops from a grocery store. Now, theoretically, one could argue that people who go around stealing food from grocery stores ought to be removed from society because they're a danger of some sort. But as a practical matter, that kind of criminal activity involves very important not only social needs, but life needs on the part of the individual, and those individuals are the ones.
Without going into the question of whether stealing lamb chops today would be petty or grand larceny, we'll return in a moment with a further discussion of this issue. So stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment. Back again, discussing the question of what's going to happen to President Nixon, former President Nixon, or what should happen, what might happen. But I'd like to return to something that Mr. Sachs said. You were talking about Special Prosecutor Jaworski, and the way I remember it, you said, who has the decision, and then you halted, and then said, has the responsibility. and without trying to delve unduly into your subconscious, did you stop there because the decision might not be Jaworski's to make?
Well, I'm not positive that it is Jaworski's, although I think it is. And that's all I had in mind. I think he has the responsibility to make the decision as to whether the case should be presented to the grand jury.
Then the next word, who then has the responsibility? If he decides that it should go to the grand jury, does somebody have a responsibility to make sure that nothing impedes the movement to the grand jury?
Only the grand jury.
The president cannot intervene? President Ford cannot intervene?
No. Jaworski, as I understand the law, if the responsibility for prosecution is Mr. Jaworski's, and I mean in that sense,
I understand.
Not the U.S. attorneys and not the attorney generals, then the procedure is for him to present or cause to be presented to the grand jury the evidence, and then the grand jury has the complete control. Now, he can refuse to sign the indictment, which has happened on rare occasions, and that would create a legal hassle of some kind. But it is the grand jury's decision.
Gentlemen, consider this from two points of view. If such an indictment goes up, or if it does not go up, what does the positive or the negative side of either instance do to rights of clients with trials pending or who have already been sentenced and have served?
Well, I would like to say as a preliminary comment to whatever we get into in answering that, is it's very difficult for lawyers, particularly lawyers who have functioned as defense counsel in the subject area, the broad subject area that we're talking about, to comment about what effect something is going to have on a trial. If any of us was involved in that particular trial, it would be clearly improper. But even when we're not involved, it's awkward. I myself have made a motion with regard to adverse pretrial publicity. I believe David has.
I didn't.
Sidney didn't. And it's difficult, having made such a motion, then to participate in the generation of what might be not publicity. But let me say that the answer to that is very much dependent upon the particular facts of each particular case.
Well, supposing Mr. Nixon refuses to honor the subpoenas, which have, to my knowledge, as of this moment, not been delivered to him or upon him, what then does this do to the cases?
Well, he will be subject to the issuance of to arrest and can be compelled to come to court to testify or take the Fifth Amendment or exercise whatever other options may be open to him.
The fact that he's a former, he's a former president does not give him any immunity from
responding
coming
to a subpoena.
To court in response.
So he'll have to be in court. The question really is whether he's going to be in court as a witness or as a defendant.
Well, let's just take it as a witness first, because that's trauma enough, as I see it, if he refuses and is bodily brought in.
I wouldn't want to speculate on any such course, and I don't really think that that's, really in the real world in this context.
What has been in the real world for the last 2 years?
My guess, with that being impertinent, is that what you're driving at is what happens in court if he does answer. Does he take the
That's
Fifth
right.
Amendment? Does he seek to exercise some other claim of privilege? Or does he talk freely? And if he does take any one of those steps, what is the impact of that on the defendants?
Right.
And I can't answer those questions.
Thank you. You clarified my question then to say you don't know. It's like the definition of...
Well, that really involves many, many considerations.
And I just think it's pure speculation in this area. But I think really the thing that Steve was talking about before, and it makes a lot of sense here, there are rights of other defendants involved that an indictment against Mr. Nixon would create real problems about. This whole problem of pretrial publicity, which some of us have been very concerned with, is a real problem. And I don't care who the defendant is, whether he be the former president of the United States or the former attorney general of the United States or somebody involved in a very serious street crime. The question of pretrial publicity and the rights of the defendant and protecting that defendant's rights is a very serious problem, which in my view, in celebrated cases, and these cases have all been celebrated, somehow gets swept under the rug. And I don't think that there is one Fifth Amendment for a celebrated defendant and another Fifth Amendment for a not-so-celebrated defendant. And that's a problem we've just never been able to deal with appropriately.
But you're not going to relate the Shepherd case to this, are you?
In a real sense, yes. Because many of the same considerations, perhaps not in the same degree in all of them, but there are a number of cases where the Supreme Court knocked out convictions on grounds of prejudicial pretrial publicity, where in my view the publicity wasn't anywhere near as pernicious as it was in these particular cases. And I think that the courts just have not reacted with enough sensitivity to this particular problem. There are ways of dealing with this, and unfortunately the alternatives in terms either of continuance or change of venue or what have you just haven't been dealt with adequately.
Are we talking about Mr. Nixon?
I'm talking about the rights of the defendants who have been involved in the indictments up to date. And this is a problem I'm quite concerned about.
But are you saying that if Nixon were indicted, that would create more adverse publicity for the others?
It's going to just compound the problem, and I don't know how you deal with it, but the problem
is very sad to begin with. If he's indicted, then they can say he told us to do it, right?
I may be poorly informed, but I don't think that the fact that there's been a great deal of publicity about cases means that people can't get a fair trial. And I don't think the courts will hold that. I think in the Shepherd case, and there were some other cases where there was an atmosphere of a furor during
quite
the trial. That's really quite different.
I think you have to take under consideration that when you're dealing with the President of the United States, there is going to be publicity. Now, I don't know how you can't ask for a change of venue for the President.
I think there is another problem, though. There is some burden on the press, I think, to try to refrain from publishing information that's inaccurate or that would be inadmissible, because the publication of that kind of evidence might prejudice a jury. But just publication of public records of things that are admissible in evidence,
isn't it the case, though, that the most injurious pre-trial publicity to Richard M. Nixon was released by Richard M. Nixon?
I'm not in a position to say yes or no, but I wouldn't be surprised.
And that there's no way any newspaper or any television network that's worth its salt could refrain without violation to its journalistic obligations from publishing.
Actually, it's even worse than that, in a sense, because I remember that lady who was the Gold Star mother, who was on in the segment before we came on, referred to President Nixon's crimes as being so much worse than the draft violators because he had violated a public trust. And it's virtually impossible to talk about something that involves a public trust and have it not be a public issue. I think the whole idea of talking about pretrial publicity in the context of the trial of a president for what he did when in office
is
out of keeping with any of the notions that we typically deal with.
We've got to say goodbye, but will somebody please tell me, is this not what we're talking about? Is this not a legal no man's land?
Pretrial publicity?
I don't know, the United States.
It is a new field for almost everybody.
I hope it'll be soon old and forgotten after this one.
Gentlemen, thank you all for coming in. Most kind of
you. Thank you.
We'll be back in a moment right after this word from Coke.
surf at Big Sur, pounding the rocks into the shape of dreams. The random energy of a Big Apple Saturday night. Iowa farmers harvesting the land near the smell of homemade bread.